All right, changing subjects altogether now.
If we can't down on Sunday.
What?
If we can't drink on Sunday.
Yeah, in Indiana. All right. Fine. Anyway, let's move on. I don't even drink. All right. A popular icebreaker that is often used in small groups goes something like this. You've probably have played this game. Each person is to go around the room sharing something about themselves that no one else would ever guess could possibly be true. And generally, people will draw up on something from their past, something they did as a kid, for instance, that would be quite unlike anything they would now do as a grown-up. Well, this is an easy game for me to play. In many respects, I'm hardly the same person. And so for our purposes this morning, I'll mention one area in particular, at least to me, that is especially striking in this regard. As an adult, I thrive on activity and projects and work. I love to stay busy. I love to build things, fix things, do things. I'm quite industrious. Recreation for me involves, you know, a demanding task like riding my bicycle all day or going on a hike all day, that kind of thing. The idea of sitting on a beach or going on a cruise has absolutely no appeal to me whatsoever. It actually sounds painful because, I need to be doing something. And even when I watch TV, as Terry will tell you, what am I doing when I'm watching TV? I'm on my treadmill. I'm what? Don't you? You're married to me. You should know what I do when I'm on my TV. I'm on my treadmill. None of this, however, would describe me as a kid. Back then, I was quite lazy, unmotivated, apathetic. For instance, I did very poorly in school from the first grade all the way to the 12th grade. I am not naturally bright, and I was simply unwilling to put in the extra work to make up for it. And actually, I was unwilling to put in any work. I did not study for tests. I put little effort into homework. I didn't pay attention during class. I was lazy. I barely graduated from high school, and I think they gave me the diploma just to get rid of me. My dad was always on me for not doing jobs that he assigned me, like mowing the yard and pulling weeds in the garden and so on, and I'd rather get a whooping than do all that stuff. And when I would do them, I'd be half-hearted about it, because lazy people do lazy work. One time, I pulled the cap off the spark plug of the mower, claiming that I couldn't get it to start. This fooled my mother, but it did not fool my dad. And when he got home from work, well, it was quite unpleasant. And it should be noted that the yard was quite large. We only had a push mower. It wasn't even self-propelled, and it was a seven-hour job. But this doesn't change the fact that I was lazy, very lazy. It would be a beautiful day outside, and my mom would say, "Go outdoors and do something." But I was quite happy to just sit in front of the TV watching reruns of Gilligan's Isle and McHale's Navy and I Dream of Jeannie, all those really bland and stupid comedies that would drive me insane today. But I had no ambition whatsoever. I was lazy, disgustingly lazy, which meant, quite frankly, that I was also a slob. My bedroom was a complete mess. There was junk and clothes all over the floor. There were none of those neatly organized shelves and color-coded boxes in that room. It was just a heap of clutter, and things were dirty. I never made my bed. I wore the same clothes every day. I didn't take care of my possessions, thought nothing of leaving them outside in the rain. I was too lazy to even brush my teeth, which resulted in a number of dental problems later on. And I took a bath about once a week. I'm laying it out for you. These are unpleasant memories for me. How could one be so aimless, so unmotivated? The name Wendell has German roots and actually means wanderer, and that name, seemed to describe my lack of focus during my childhood and teenage years. Fortunately, I have since then made some pretty significant changes. I bathe more often, for one thing. There was no radical night conversion from being a sloth. Like many others, I just grew out of it. And there were a number of factors involved. One comes to realize that being productive reaps many benefits, whereas laziness reaps many problems. And once you're on your own, this hard truth of life becomes very real. My first full-time job was that of being a grunt for a brick mason, and that was hard work, and it required a lot of hustle. I hated that job. I hated it. Hated it a lot, but I needed it. Not because I needed the money, though I did, but more so I needed the experience, and I needed that discipline. And some of this change, actually a lot of it, was the result of my conversion to Christ. Being productive is pleasing to God. It is how he designed us. And so, as you know, it's quite fulfilling to apply oneself. Laziness, on the other hand, is condemned in Scripture as a sin in both the Old and New Testaments and leaves one feeling yucky and dissatisfied. Soon after my conversion, in my early 20s, I was spending a fair amount of time in the book of Proverbs. It was one of the books I could understand. all those verses that address work and laziness really stood out to me. Many of them employ colorful language to press home the point, and those had quite an impact. And I was introduced to a new word, a word that I had never heard of before, quite honestly, and it's a word that I would never forget. Anyone want to take a guess what that word is? The sluggard. Close. Yeah, the sluggard. What a descriptive term. Those proverbs helped to form in me a better work ethic, a better appreciation for the wisdom of being productive, of applying oneself. And to this day, I still have a great appreciation for those particular proverbs. I still don't like to mow the yard, but a couple verses in Proverbs 24 that we'll look at later do help move me along in that area. So if you would, I'm going to ask you to turn to the book at this time, and we're going to look at some of those verses that address work, laziness, and related themes. And if you happen to be on the lazy side of the spectrum, or if others have pointed out to you that you tend to be lazy, and maybe this is a blind spot in your area, in your life, but either way, we have here wisdom from God given to us as a gift. It really is a gift to help us maximize the opportunity of this life, to be good stewards of the time that the Lord has provided us. So I have several of these to look at, and to make them easier to find, we're going to look at them in the order that they are given, and I'll be reading them from the 1984 NIV, which may be a little bit different than the version that you're using, but hopefully it will be close enough. So the first one is found in chapter 6, starting at verse 6. And I would guess that many of these are familiar to you, but some of them are really quite striking when you take a deeper look at them. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit, and scarcity like an armed man. All right, well, this proverb, of course, uses irony to make its point. The ant, an insignificant, unintelligent, trivial, and inconsequential insect, very low on the food chain, displays even more godly wisdom than a lot of people. The ant doesn't need anyone to tell it what to do, while the sluggard refuses the direction that it is offered. The ant knows when it's time to work and is aware of what is coming and prepares for it. It can count on food in lean times. The sluggard, however, lies in bed, begging for a little more time to sleep, and then is surprised when poverty overtakes him. So the proverb is rather comical that the lazy are exhorted to look to something like an ant for inspiration. It does a pretty good job of the irony here. Let's go now to chapter 10. We'll start with verse 4. Lazy hands make a man poor, but diligent hands bring wealth. He who gathers crops in summer is a wise son, but he who sleeps during harvest is a disgraceful son. So here we see that diligence and laziness are actually moral issues. One of them is regarded as wise, the other as disgraceful. And indeed, diligent labor is a byproduct of wisdom that flows from a reverence for God. A couple verses later, 10:26, as vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is a sluggard to those who send him. So like many proverbs, the wisdom here works in two directions. Save yourself the headache and avoid those situations that this proverb warns about. In other words, don't hire lazy people, regardless of how charming they may be. And secondly, this is a warning to not be a pain to other people. Don't be unreliable and irresponsible. If you are, you will be as irritating and painful as you will be as irritating and painful as smoke is to the eyes. A companion proverb found in 25:19, you don't have to turn there. It says, like a bad tooth or a lame foot is reliance on the unfaithful in times of trouble. Quite descriptive. All right, let's turn to chapter 12. Look at verse 11, if you would. He who works his land will have abundant food, but he who chases fantasies lacks judgment. You can't eat fantasy, obviously, so this is a warning against all those get-rich-quick schemes that promise great reward without the investment of diligent labor. 12:27, the lazy man does not roast his game, but the diligent man prizes his possessions. So the lesson here, of course, goes well beyond that of cooking what somebody catches. Those who are lazy are marked by an inability to finish what they start. Their lives are riddled with unfinished work and unfinished projects. 13:4, the sluggard craves and gets nothing, but the desires of the diligent are fully satisfied. So rather than spending all day hoping for things that they do not have, the diligent will work toward realizing their desires. 14:23, all hard work brings a profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. So, of course, words can do many things, but they cannot create wealth out of nothing. 15:19, the way of the sluggard is blocked with thorns, but the path of the upright is a highway. So why is it blocked by thorns? Well, again, because of his laziness. He allowed them to overrun things. To avoid work, the sluggard has actually taken the more difficult path. Think of the person who doesn't mow their yard until the middle of July. We all know people like that. We all have neighbors like that. Things would just be a whole lot easier if they'd started in late April. So this proverb paints a contrast between a path blocked by briars and thistles and undergrowth with a highway. And a highway, of course, is a good picture because it's a properly constructed road from which work was once invested in so as to make things easier in the future. Easier and indeed permanent. So the point is that those who are lazy are unwilling to make or unwilling to do the work to make things better for tomorrow. 18:19. One who is slack in his work is brother to one who destroys. Similar idea here. Sloppy, half-hearted, shoddy work is nothing short of vandalism. We're actually going to talk more about that later, either today or perhaps next week. 19:15. Laziness brings on deep sleep, and the shiftless man goes hungry. Shiftless is just another word for lazy, and this proverb, of course, describes the endless cycle of a sluggard's life. Laziness, sleep, hunger. Laziness, sleep, hunger. Laziness, sleep, hunger. 19:24. I like this one. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish. He will not even bring it back to his mouth. We need to visualize that. This is one of several proverbs that makes its point with what we'd call hyperbolic comedy. There's exaggeration going on here, but it is quite funny. We have a picture here of a table that has been set, plates filled with food. The sluggard is seated with fork in hand, but he's too lazy to even feed himself, too lazy to even lift his fork up to his mouth. And the point is similar to that as we looked at earlier. The issue here really isn't about eating food. It's just a picture to paint the problem. When a sluggard, even when a sluggard can muster enough ambition to start something, they lack the ambition to finish it. 20:4. A sluggard does not plow in season, so at harvest time he looks but finds nothing. And this one also includes a little bit of comedy to drive home the point, because equally ridiculous, the sluggard has not plowed his field or planted his crops, and yet harvest time he goes out in the field and there's nothing there to harvest. And he's surprised by that. 20:13, do not love sleep or you will grow poor. Stay awake and you will have food to spare. Doesn't really need any explanation. 22:13, the sluggard says, there is a lion outside, or I will be murdered in the streets. The lazy look for any excuse to get out of work. And then 26, 26:13-16. These actually combine two proverbs that we have already have looked at, but we'll still read it here. The sluggard says, "There is a lion in the road, a fierce lion roaming the streets. As a door turns on its hinges, so a sluggard turns on his bed. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish. He is too lazy to bring it back to his mouth. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who answer discreetly." So again, the sluggard will not begin things. He uses preposterous excuses to justify his laziness. There's a lion in the street. And he will not finish things. He jabs the food with a fork, but too lazy to raise it back to his mouth. And again, these are just simply pictures describing the character of a lazy person. And as a result, they are ridiculed and regarded as foolish and undependable, which they are. Unfortunately, as the proverb ends there on that note, they fail to see it. You know, we laugh at their ridiculous excuses, and but those excuses make perfect sense to them. And this, of course, is a major blind spot for them. And as verse 16 points out, they regard themselves as smarter than those who see their flaws. In fact, one could say that the sluggard's ego may be the only part of him that gets any exercise. All right, one more. And here we're going to actually turn back a page or so, looking at chapter 24 in verse 30. We'll end with this one. And here's the one that haunts me when I don't want to mow the yard. "I went past the field of the sluggard, past the vineyard of the man who lacks judgment. Thorns had come up everywhere, the ground was covered with weeds, and the stone wall was in ruins. I applied my heart to what I observed and learned a lesson from what I saw. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit and scarcity like an armed man." So we have here a vivid picture of the sluggard's dilapidated field and vineyard, weeds everywhere, the house needs painted, the roof on the shed needs replaced, junk laying around the front yard, the yard needs mowed, you know, all this seems to be innocent, no big deal. But as this proverb points out, this is more than just a lifestyle or a personal quirk. It represents something deeper. At the very least, such a person, to say what the proverb says, lacks judgment. And because really, what does it say about a person who doesn't take the trouble to value his property and possessions, to recognize them as the gifts from the Lord that they really are, and by taking care of them? You know, what could you possibly entrust such a person with? If he won't respect his own home, what makes you think that he will respect yours? If he won't take care of his own belongings, what makes you think that he will be responsible with yours? So this lack of judgment, again, indicates a moral flaw of laziness. Well, I'm grateful for these and for other verses. They helped forge in me a rightful disgust for laziness and a proper appreciation for ambition and diligence, which was badly needed in my life. And again, these just want to reinstate this. These proverbs are God's gift to us. Wisdom for daily living. Wisdom to help us maximize the opportunity of this life. Now, there are, of course, passages in the New Testament that speak to these principles as well, that lend their amen to these truths. We won't look at all of them, but a couple that especially stand out are from 2 Thessalonians. They're familiar to you. If a man will not work, he shall not eat. I mean, this is pretty direct. And also in that book, keep away from every brother who is idle. It's pretty strong language. And such strong words is probably the reason laziness was included in the list, in that list of the seven deadly sins, a list that goes back to the 4th century. Pride, greed, lust, envy, gluttony, wrath, and sloth. Again, laziness is just not a lifestyle or some sort of personal quirk. It is to be regarded as a serious moral failure. And then we have this passage from Titus, which I believe, you know, everyone should commit to memory. It's a great verse. Titus 3:14, "Our people must learn to devote themselves to doing what is good in order that they may provide for daily necessities and not live unproductive lives." Well, a lot could be said about this business of living a productive life. One area that I just want to talk about here, take this opportunity to talk about, one area in particular that keeps coming up now that I'm in my mid-60s is, of course, retirement. because I have friends who are retiring or getting ready for it, and I'm not sure what this will look like for me. It's going to be a ways off, but this verse raises questions that I think deserve some consideration. How is laying on a beach in Florida day after day a productive life? Or playing golf day after day after day? Or driving around America in a motorhome, taking in the sights? Or spending all day sitting by a lake, fishing? I'm getting a lot of angry looks right now. Obviously, none of these activities are wrong, but is it really God's design that we spend all our time, day after day, month after month, year after year, on leisure? You know, if you don't need the money and your health is good, then spend at least some of that time volunteering for a charity or a mission or a Christian ministry or something, something productive. You know, we are built for work. We really do need to appreciate this. This is how God designed both our bodies and our minds. We are made in the image of a creator, one who planned his work, then worked his plan. And this is how we are internally wired. We are meant to be creators, producers, makers, workers. And this is true for 70-year-olds contemplating retirement, and it's true for 20-year-olds hoping to mooch off their parents as long as they can. It's a truth. We are made for work. In the first chapters of Genesis, as you will recall, before the order is given to not eat from the tree of life, God gives Adam and Eve the charge to work the Garden of Eden and to take care of it. And even before that, he told Adam to name the animals. There's work involved in this. And the charge to work is how the Bible ends as well in the last chapter of Revelation. There in the final verses of Holy Scripture, we are told that in the new creation, we will serve the Lamb throughout all eternity. Serve. If you don't like work in this life, you will certainly hate what is coming. Play, recreation, and free time are great and are indeed a gift from God. And one can certainly worship work. And that's a whole other subject in itself. But this, you know, this warning the Proverbs gives about honey that we've looked at in previous weeks, too much of it will make you sick, it applies. Too much of it, too much leisure is not a good thing. Eating only honey is not how God designed us. And likewise, he did not design us to spend all our time on leisure either, or even most of our time. You know, our people must learn to devote themselves to doing what is good and not live unproductive lives, Paul exhorted. Okay, I was going to actually save this for next week, but I got just a few more minutes here, and I'm just going to go ahead and go for it here on this subject. Kind of turn the corner a little bit, but still on the subject of work. Though these verses in the New Testament, all those Proverbs, as I mentioned, have served me well, my understanding and appreciation for work has continued to progress. And in the last 10 or 15 years, I've been introduced to some resources that have wrestled with the overall philosophy of work from God's perspective. So you might think of the Proverbs as exhorting us with the practicality of work. The New Testament exhorts us with the obligation to work. But the reason itself for work, the bigger picture of how it serves as a service to the Lord, is something that is gained really from the whole counsel of God's Word. And this too can be quite insightful and helpful, and it has been for me. And one resource in particular is that book by Dorothy Sayers that I spoke of a couple months ago, Creed or Chaos. And she has a chapter titled, Why Work? And she answers that question in a way that I think is quite profound and provocative and inspiring. So bear with me here for just a few moments while I finish on this particular note. Work should be looked upon, she says in the opening paragraph of that chapter, not as a necessary drudgery to be undergone for the purpose of making money, but as a way of life in which the nature of many should find its proper exercise and delight, and so fulfill itself to the glory of God, that it should, in fact, be thought of as creative activity undertaken for the love of the work itself, and that man, made in God's image, should make things as God makes them, for the sake of doing well a thing that is well worth doing. That's something you don't hear much about today. I mean, everything in our culture is driven by the paycheck. And even Christians, we are conditioned to think this way. You know, that work is meaningless, it's unspiritual, it's only a means to an end, something you have to do. And this attitude, according to Dorothy Sayers, is a sad tragedy. It was never meant to be understood that way. So let me read a few selected chapters from, selected paragraphs from this chapter, because she makes her points really eloquently and forcefully. From page 93, we have had to learn the bitter lesson that in all the world there are only two sources of real wealth, the fruit of the earth and the labor of men, and to estimate work not by the money it brings to the producer, but by the worth of the thing that is made. That particular point, that we should estimate the value of our work by the worth of the thing that is made, is something she states quite effectively later on on page 98. You'll like this. The habit of thinking about work as something one does to make money is so ingrained in us that we can scarcely imagine what a revolutionary change it would be to think about it instead in terms of the work done. To do so would mean taking the attitude of mind we reserve for our unpaid work, our hobbies, our leisure interests, the things we make and do for pleasure, and making that the standard of all our judgments about things and people. We should ask of an enterprise, not will it pay, but is it good? Of goods, not can we induce people to buy them, but are they useful things, well made? Of employment, not how much a week, but will it exercise my faculties to the utmost? And shareholders in, let us say, brewing companies would astonish the directorate by arising at shareholders' meetings and demanding to know not merely where the profits go or what dividends are to be paid, not even merely whether the workers' wages are sufficient and the conditions of labor satisfactory, but loudly and with a proper sense of personal responsibility, ask, what goes into the beer? Are you getting the point of this? After the making the case that because we are made in the image of God, work therefore is the natural exercise and function of man, she goes on to spell out three propositions in what she calls the Christian understanding of work. On page 101, the first is that work is not primarily a thing one does to live, but the thing one lives to do. It is, or should be, the full expression of the worker's faculties, the thing in which he finds spiritual, mental, and physical satisfaction, and the medium in which he offers himself to God. We should no longer think of work as something that we hasten to get through in order to enjoy our leisure. We should look upon our leisure as the period of changed rhythm that refreshes us for the delightful purpose of getting on with our work. We don't hear stuff like that. This is really quite profound. And then on page 105, my second proposition is this. It is the business of the church to recognize that the secular vocation as such is sacred. The clergy must get it into their heads that when a man or woman is called to a particular job of secular work, that it is as true a vocation as though he or she were called to specifically religious work or church work. The work itself is a service to God and must be accepted and respected as a medium of divine creation. The church's approach to an intelligent carpenter is usually confined to exhorting him to not be drunk and disorderly in his leisure hours and to come to church on Sundays. What the church should be telling him is this, that the very demand that his religion makes upon him is that he should make good tables. She goes on explaining how no one should not insult God with bad carpentry, as an example, that no crooked table legs or ill-fitting drawers came out of that carpenter's shop in Nazareth. But perhaps my favorite paragraph in the whole chapter is this, still under this proposition number two. She writes, in her own buildings, in her own ecclesiastical art and music, in her hymns and prayers, in her sermons, and in her little books of devotion, the church will tolerate or permit a pious intention to excuse work so ugly, so pretentious, so tawdry and twaddling, so insincere and insipid, so bad as to shock and horrify any decent draftsman. What a scolding. So think again of that proverb we read earlier. One who is slack in his work is brother to one who destroys. Shoddy work is no better than vandalism because both amount to the same thing. And now to skip ahead to page 111, she says, this brings me to my third proposition, and this may sound to you the most revolutionary of all. It is this: the worker's first duty is to serve the work. And Sayers there argues that we often put the second commandment of loving others above the first commandment of loving God, and that this has resulted in all sorts of problems, and that this shows up even in how we value our work. Our first desire should be to please the Lord with our labor, not ourselves, not even others, and not even those for whom the work is meant to benefit. So I don't have time to lay out all her points about that, but they're certainly worth reading and thinking about. But this particular paragraph toward the end of that chapter captures a sense of that argument on page 113. If you set out to serve the community, you will probably end by merely fulfilling a public demand, and you may not even do that. A public demand is a changeable thing. 9/10 of the bad plays put on in theaters owe their badness to the fact that the playwright was aimed at pleasing the audience instead of producing a good and satisfactory play. Instead of doing the work as integrity demands that it should be done, he has falsified the play by putting in this or that which he thinks will appeal to the groundlings, those spectators who sit in the cheapest seats of the theater and have no critical judgment. The work has been falsified to please the public, and in the end, even the public is not pleased. As it is with all works of art, so it is with all work. The end of the work will be decided by our religious outlook. As we are, so we make. And then she concludes the chapter with this sentence: perhaps we may put it shortly, more shortly still, if work is to find its right place in the world, it is the duty of the church to see to it that the work serves God and that the worker serves the work. So with that in mind, let me just close with this point. And this captures, of course, or that doesn't capture, this is where Dorothy is really coming up with these whole principles, is that after God made the heavens and the earth, he looked up on his creation, and what did he say about it? It was good. And being made in his image, we should have the same desire and purpose, that what we do would not be shoddy or substandard or sloppy, but good. Oh, good. We should make things as God makes them for the sake of doing well, a thing that is well worth doing. All right, so let's stand, and I'll close with these words from Solomon, taken from his other book of wisdom, Ecclesiastes. He writes, "A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction." Excuse me. "A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too I see is from the hand of God, for without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness." Go in Christ's name. Enjoy each other and serve each other in love. You are dismissed.